Lutheran pastor in Omaha, Nebraska, very conservative part of the country. They were given two, you know, sessions of psilocybin. He had what he called something of a crisis of faith, and he overcame it. But initially, the crisis was, how can I go back and just preach the same doctrine and dogma that I preached before when I've seen this much bigger vision of the divine? And so he's found a way to, you know, integrate that into his ministry.
Don.
Luke.
Welcome to the MAPS Canada podcast.
Thank you. Thank
you. Glad to have you here.
Hey, great to speak with you.
Don Lan is a veteran religion journalist and author of several books on psychedelics, including the Harvard Psychedelic Club. I have it over in the shot over there. And his latest book, God on Psychedelics. A very fascinating book. So he's a speaker here at Psychedelic Science 2023 conference that we're at, the world's biggest ever conference on psychedelics. It was up to around 12,000 attendees.
Yeah,
which incredible. Is crazy.
Incredible.
Crazy. You've been closely following the psychedelic movement forever. For a long
Not
time.
Not quite forever, but almost.
Yeah. For a long time. And so I'm looking forward to your valuable perspective on the scene, especially now that the Renaissance is really ramping up these days. Rick Doblin, in his opening address, mentioned some cultural inflection points, including the number of research that's happening. It's like right now, it's like three times the peak in the 60s, the number of papers published per year. So,
yeah.
You know, things are really growing.
Yeah.
How are you doing? How's the conference been for you?
Well, you're right. It is a bit overwhelming. I mean, just the crowds and the energy, but there is a really nice feeling. You know, it's something about people in the psychedelic space. You know, they tend to look you in the eye. There's a lot more smiling. You know, it's got a nice vibe, but there's also this kind of frantic running around, people trying to see everything. You know, it's like a 12-ring circus. There's so many things going on at the same time, you know, simultaneously.
Yeah.
So it's this weird mix of like serenity and people frantically running around. You know, it's kind of cool to feel it, you know.
For sure. Yeah. I've been running around between doing interviews here in the booth and seeing talks and stuff, but yeah, it's been amazing.
Yeah.
How quickly you can connect with people.
Yeah.
Too.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
I just did a book signing at the bookstore, and I just had such a wonderful turnout with people, and people saying things like, I wrote a book called Distilled Spirits, which is partly a recovery memoir. And it's the story of Bill Wilson, the co-founder of AA, Aldous Huxley, everyone's known, and Gerald Hurd. Anyway, you know, this woman came up and said, your book saved my life. It really helped me with my recovery from alcoholism.
Wow.
You know, and something like that, when that happens, you know, it's like, wow, this is why I'm doing this, you know.
Wow.
Doesn't matter that it didn't maybe sell as many copies as I wanted, you know, when it has an impact like that on people's lives. And so when I hear that, when I do signings, it really... You know, it revives me. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. I feel that with some of our YouTube videos that might get less views. But one comment saying I discovered psychedelics and changed my life makes all the difference.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing. So yeah, in your new book, God on Psychedelics, you report on a study that hasn't been put out yet.
Right.
On Christian clergy members who had psilocybin experiences through NYU John Hopkins study. And
not just Christian, by the way.
Yes.
Christian,
yes.
Jewish, Muslim, yeah.
Which surprised me that there's some Orthodox and some very non-psychedelic oriented denominations.
Yeah, well, it's not really representative in various ways, but they did have quite a mix.
Yeah.
Did have quite a mix.
Yeah. And so they gave us preliminary results the other day, which was really exciting to see, since seeing that after reading the book and the what you shared from your research into the research.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you make of the results that you saw the other day here and overall?
Well, actually, they haven't released the quantitative results yet.
Yeah.
All the numbers and the analysis like that. All they did yesterday was they told a few anecdotes, personal stories anonymously from some of the participants, which is very similar to what I did in this book. They've been trying to keep this kind of quiet until they released the study. But, you know, I'm a journalist and, you know, I sort of sought out a few of the participants who agreed to talk. So last year I had some lengthy interviews with three or four of the clergy members. And it's very similar to the little tidbits they offered yesterday. You know, it was a range of reactions that people had. You know, these are people who were psychedelically naive. They'd never tripped before. But of course they were open to it because they volunteered for this study. They were given two, you know, sessions of psilocybin about a month apart. And the idea was to see how it affects both their personal life and their ministry, you know, how they work with their congregations. And there was a real range of reactions. Actually, some people say it really revived their faith. You know, kind of mainline Protestant ministers, Episcopalians who were more kind of intellectual maybe in their faith, sort of felt like a bodily energy of the divine, maybe a Holy Spirit, which they would say, oh, that's for Pentecostals, you know, that's not for, you know, progressive, you know, rational, you know, intellectual Christians like us, but they felt that spirit. And it helped, it sort of made mundane kind of rituals, like holiday rituals they do every year, gave new meaning and spirit into that. On the other hand, some of the, there's a man I profile, a Lutheran pastor in Omaha, Nebraska, very conservative part of the country. I mean, medical marijuana isn't even legal in Nebraska. He had what he called something of a crisis of faith. Because he had this experience of God that was much bigger than he had imagined. He said he had kind of put God in this small box. And so the crisis was, and he overcame it, but initially the crisis was, how can I go back and just preach the same doctrine and dogma that I preached before when I've seen this much bigger, kind of more open vision of the divine, and how can I... one of the things he said was, he feels more like a chaplain than a pastor. In the chaplain, he's more interested in hearing what his congregants feel about God and the divine rather than telling, this is what God teaches. You know, more open-minded, you know, which was beautiful. And so he's found a way to, you know, integrate that into his ministry. So there's some really interesting stories coming out of this study, which, like you mentioned, has not been published yet, but, you know, as a journalist who, like, you know, can't wait and try to get the inside track on this, you know, I did track some of these folks down and had some really revealing interviews with them.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Thank you. Yeah. And it was very interesting. They revealed that none of the clergy members dropped out of their role, of their job. They all maintained their role.
Yeah, I mean, this Lutheran pastor that I mentioned, nothing really to do with the study, but what's happening in a lot of the mainline churches, like the Lutheran, Methodist, Episcopalian, they're losing members. Nothing to do with the psychedelic study.
Yeah.
But there's a steep decline in attendance and affiliation. So his church, actually, between the time I first interviewed him more than a year ago and now, actually shut down. Nothing to do with the psychedelics, but it certainly didn't revive it. He wasn't even talking about it. Most of these clergymen didn't go back and preach, you know, sermons that they've discovered, you know, a new meaning, the meaning of life or a new vision of God. They kept it quiet. Yeah. But he managed to get another appointment at another church himself. Right. But none of them sort of gave up ministry, at least so far. Because it's a problem with clergy burnout, you know, especially in this climate, of course, with COVID, that's really been hard on the churches, as a lot of aspects of society. I think a lot of these clergy members are kind of just interested in have new ways of envisioning the divine that's still within, that doesn't really conflict with the teachings of their church. And there's a little dance you have to play there.
Yeah. And it was interesting that they mentioned, and it's very interesting that there's a steep, sharp decline. They mentioned just at the question period at the end of the talk, they added, they're like, oh, by the way, for some of the pastors or whatever, forgive me, I'm not totally familiar with all the religious leaders, who had gone back, there was actually an increase in attendance of their churches. Who had gone through the ceremony.
Yeah. They said four had reported that. That's out of 24, so you got to remember that.
Right.
And, you know, I don't know if you can really... they had maybe a sense that there was a different energy and maybe that helped. And very well could be. But I don't think that's like, you know, you can really make a scientific conclusion around that. You'd have to really study.
Yeah.
You'd have to interview the members of the congregation.
Right.
You know, there's a tendency in this world to kind of fall into a little too much hype and hope.
Right.
You know, and I don't think they're going to say that there's a direct, we'll see when the study comes out, but they're not really looking at it at that level where they can make conclusions like that.
Got it.
The other thing to remember about this study is they're all self-selected.
Right.
So while they were psychedelically naive, they're obviously open to this, right? And it's a small group. It's 24, you know, clergy yeah. members. And, yeah, there is, and Roland Griffiths, the lead investigator, said that there is a problem with expectancy bias. You know, these clergy members read stories about this study, including, I wrote probably the first story about this study happening back in 2015. Actually, Roland Griffiths asked me to write a story because they couldn't find any clergy. They were looking for, and I've been a religion writer for a long time. I have 1 foot in the psychedelic world and 1 foot in the kind of mainstream religious world. So I did do an article that Roland was doing a study. They were having trouble finding clergy. And so he talked about it. I sort of gave some of my opinions about what's going on. And the story was written for Religion News Service, but it popped up in various newspapers across the country and in this magazine, a kind of a progressive Christian liberal magazine called Christian Century. Some of the participants, including Hunt Priest, read my article. That's how they heard about it.
Yeah.
So their ideas going into it were influenced by what I was saying and what I was quoting Roland as saying. So, you know, expectancy bias is, I think, and a lot of people who will sort of dismiss this will point that out. And Roland admitted that's a factor, you know, yeah. and we have to acknowledge that.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
and it's not a representative survey, a representative sample of clergy at
yeah.
all.
Yeah, yeah.
It's more Christian in some ways, but probably fewer Catholics. They still had trouble attracting Roman Catholics.
Yeah.
So, and that's the largest religious denomination in the country is Roman
yeah.
Catholics. So,
right.
you know, temper this with, you know, some reality, but
yeah.
the individual stories, I think those are what are interesting. You know, I don't think they're going to be able to have any kind of, you know, quantitative conclusions about anything from this study. But the, right. the stories that people are telling me and that they tell in God and Psychedelics are really powerful and inspiring in some ways.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And he also, so I'm curious to ask also about sort of the, what is the hope, what is the hype?
Yeah.
And also to reflect that Roland also gave a very sort of strong warning on the risk of, I mean, what we could sum up as sort of detribalization. He spoke about the potential negative effects on culture on a larger scale if, say, you know, a large percentage of, say, American Christians or Christian clergy members or other denominations or faiths yeah. Were to do so. And that he it wasn't clear if there would be, like, a large positive or negative effect.
Yeah, I think he was talking about not so much clergy. He was talking about just the larger so-called psychedelic renaissance and all the excitement and all the decriminalization, the stuff that's happening outside of the clinical trials. That's what they're really worried about. They're worried about a backlash, which happened similar to in the 1960s when it just got too wild and crazy. And they're, you know, these drugs, while, you know, they're not, for the most part, physically addictive, they have risks, psychological risks for people who are not ready for them.
Yeah.
And nothing to do with the clinical trials, just what's happening in the whole decriminalization and this explosion of interest in this in the media, in the popular media. And I think a lot of the researchers are really worried about, you know, some, and there are already reports of, you know, some bad outcomes and a backlash against it, which could affect the clinical trials. So
right.
they're now trying to, like, let's slow it down. Let's slow it down. They're talking more about the decriminalization, the legal drug reform thing, which is needed, and I'm all for it, and everybody is. But, you know, there's a kind of an irrational exuberance that, oh, this is going to save the world. And, well, it didn't save the world in the 60s, and I don't think it's going to save the world in the 2020s either. You know, it's not that simple.
Got it. Yeah. Awesome. So then the flip side, what is the hope that is offered by, say, you know, the results of the study so far, what you've seen and the potential benefits for, say, clergy members or even just Christians who are curious about psychedelics?
Yeah, specifically for the religious study.
Yeah. Hey, we hope you're enjoying the podcast so far. Now, if you want to support and become part of the psychedelic movement, feel free to donate to MAPS Canada at the link in the description below. Thank you for helping our mission to support equitable access to legal and regulated psychedelic medicines for all Canadians.
Well, I think what's happening is, like I said, there is this decline, and even the clergy that are open to this, they're not even thinking this is going to, like, save the institutional church necessarily. It's not necessarily going to inspire people to start going to church in the old ways that they're used to. But what's happening, and this is not just from this study, this is just happening anyway, the fastest growing religion in America are the nuns, not the N-U-N, N-O-N-E-S. Oh. The N-O-N-E-S. The nuns. And these are people. These are people. Yeah. These are people.
No way.
These are people, when you say, what is your religion? What is your religious affiliation? Are you Christian, Jewish, Muslim, Buddhist, Hindu? Yeah. They'll say none, as in none of the above, N-O-N-E. Right. But most of those people wouldn't call themselves, and there's polling on this, right. Most of those people wouldn't call themselves atheists or maybe even agnostics. I mean, a lot of them still believe in God. They maybe still read the Bible. They might even still call themselves Christian or not, but they are more open to kind of a broader definition of the divine. A lot of people will call them, a lot of people refer to themselves these days as spiritual but not religious.
Right.
Sometimes they call those the nuns, N-O-N-E-S.
Right.
And so what's happening is that there are new kinds of forms of worship and community arising, small groups. And it can be like a meditation group, which may have a Christian or Jewish focus, but a meditation group, yoga, 12-step fellowships of people in recovery, which has a spiritual aspect, ecstatic dance, and yes, psychedelic churches and psychedelic fellowships. So there's this small group movement of people. I've heard the word being used, communities of discernment.
Yeah.
So these are, and in terms of the psychedelic scene, it's like people who are having these experiences on psychedelics, you know, they want a group of people to, people use the word integrate, but also just to sort of discuss and talk about it and find new forms of community and fellowship and some really interesting stuff. So the book, my book is not just, there's a couple chapters on the mainstream clergy, this avant-garde that are open to this. And it is an avant-garde. It's just the beginning. It's not sweeping America, believe me.
Yeah, yeah.
You get that impression when you listen to some of the people here. It's not happening. It's the very beginning.
Right.
In a way, this book is like maybe 10 years ahead of its time because it's just started. But at the same time, you have these underground, you can call them churches, fellowships, shamanic groups, all kinds of things that are now coming above ground because there's less threat of legal repercussions, whether states have changed the law or not. You know, cities across the country are trying to decriminalize certain psychedelics. So there's... there's that. There's the underground coming above ground, and then there are the established, very beginnings of established clergy being at least open to talking about this, maybe having retreats when it's legal for people to go and explore psychedelics as part of their faith, whatever their faith is.
Right, right. Yeah. And funny thing, actually, thank you for sharing that.
Yeah.
When I first arrived in Denver for the conference, I went to this cafe for a psychedelic meetup and was ushered upstairs, where I walked into this circle of people sitting with this bowl of psilocybin microdoses in the middle of the room.
Uh-huh.
And I slowly realized that I'd accidentally found myself as part of a psychedelic church service.
Accidentally.
Someone said, oh, there's this organization, come check out what we do. I'm like, what do you do? He's like, well, come experience it. And they're speaking about faith and they're speaking about prayer. In sort of a psychedelic context. And I realized the service, it was great. And they took the sacrament, which was the microdose. And afterwards I spoke with the person running it. And she was saying that they hadn't been a church, but they recently decided to become a church specifically to get the legal protections.
And right, that that's happening all over, yeah.
Yeah, and one of the benefits I see of that is that for people who are looking for those experiences in that community, having that sort of legal protection might contribute to the safety aspect of the setting, say if they do full dose journeys. I'm actually not sure if they do that, but they might feel safer in that context. But, you know, I'm curious about your thoughts on sort of the pros and cons of using that sort of church loophole to create these spaces.
Yeah. Well, there's a chapter in God on Psychedelics on a really interesting church in Oakland, California, called Sacred Garden Church. And I think they are one of the more, you know, sincere efforts to start a church that's open to the use of not just sacred plant medicines, also LSD, MDMA. But they're very cautious, you know, and they require new members to go to like 9 events beforehand where there's no psychedelics. You know, they have regular Sunday services where there's no microdosing, no macrodosing. It's just they're discussing it. They're talking about different psychoactive plants. And so you get to know them, they get to know you before you have an initiation. which in their case is usually with this chonga, which is the same plants that they use to brew ayahuasca tea, but you smoke it.
Yeah.
And they do this in a park in the Oakland Hills, and that's kind of the initiation ceremony. And I think they're a sincere, so I went through that whole process more as a journalist and participant observer. I mean, I was open to maybe joining, you know, I really was. It wasn't, in the end, it wasn't really for me, just because of the stage of life I'm in or whatever. But I think they are really a sincere effort. On the other hand, and they hope and claim that because they're calling themselves a church and being cautious and having accountability, for instance, there's an ethics council. So if someone, they have an ethics council. So if someone feels like there was some kind of inappropriate sexual thing going on, which often is a situation in churches, whether they're psychedelic or Roman Catholic, there's a separate ethics council that you can go to. And even beyond that, if you still think there's a problem, they're part of this thing called the Sacred Plant Alliance, which is a network of churches, so you can appeal to that. So there's double layer of accountability. That's why I think they're, you know, compared to some of the other churches, some of these other churches are just fronts. I mean, there's a thing in Zidor in Oakland too, which is basically, they call themselves a church. I mean, I think the leader is sincere in some ways, but they're basically a mushroom dispensary.
Right.
You join the church, then you get mushrooms that day and you leave. That's not a church, that's a dispensary. You know, I'm not against that, but calling it a church is not going to give you legal protection. And even Sacred Garden, I mean, you know, lawyers will disagree. I mean, it's to be clearly legal and under US law, you have to get an exemption to the religious, this is my opinion, people disagree. And I'm not a lawyer, but a lot of lawyers say, you have to get an official exemption from the religious freedom under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act.
Right.
And it's a whole process, and very few of these churches have done it. So it's really not actually true that they are clearly legal. They some of them are claiming to be, and the government is, for the most part, hands off unless they make too much noise or there's some bad outcomes or people complain. So yeah, it's not so simple. You don't just say you're a church and then you don't have to worry about it. And I think there's a lot of people who think that and could get in trouble because this is still illegal.
Yeah.
Especially under, even in the states that have done this, it's still illegal under federal law.
Yeah.
I mean, marijuana is illegal under federal law, you know, so that's, we're not in a post-prohibition era yet. People are acting like it, but it hasn't happened yet. It's happened in little pockets.
Yeah, and
Oregon and Colorado being the first states.
Yeah, and it's funny that sort of federal versus state thing, being Canadian, crossing the border, you know, marijuana is legal in Washington, it's legal in Canada, but that little thin strip just across the border.
It's called the federal government.
Super illegal, and you know, they casually
even
ask,
getting on an airplane.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I thought of that, you know, man. I still think of that. I mean, so I don't really actually do much of psychedelics and that much, but I do have these gummies. Mostly CBD, but with a little THC, like which I do use for sleeping. I don't get high at all on them.
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't bring them because it's technically, if I go through, you know, security at the airport, I could get busted. I mean, it's very unlikely to happen, or they could take them. You know, that's more likely to happen. So I actually, you have to be aware of that.
Yeah.
Going from state to state, like from Colorado, we're in Colorado now. Nebraska, like I mentioned, I think, is very, medical marijuana isn't legal in Nebraska.
Yeah. Yeah.
So taking one gummy with any THC in it across the border from into Nebraska, it's a felony.
Yeah.
In Nebraska.
Yeah.
Right.
Very scary.
Yeah.
Very scary. Yeah, yeah. Especially being Canadian in the border, like the consequences for us is like permanent banning, 5-year banning, things like that if you're caught with anything. So yeah, I mean, it speaks to sort of for the risks are real for us crossing because we have to be aware.
And if you get stopped by a border guard, you say, oh, I'm in a church. This is legal. Good luck with that, Luke.
So we're very careful. We don't break the laws.
Yeah.
We don't break the laws. Hello, U.S. Customs and Borders agents. Looking this up.
No, people are forgetting that, you know. People are forgetting that.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, so I'm curious. So study was about clergy. That was the part I was most interested in. But so there's, you know, psychedelic therapy is a secular phenomenon. Yet in the 2006 groundbreaking Roland Griffith study about how mystical type experiences, caution around using the word mystical on its own, mystical type experience, occasion, significant, meaningful experiences. There's a correlation in the degree of the mystical experience and the degree of the positive outcomes, if I'm correct. And so there's clearly a spiritual dimension to these experiences, even in a therapeutic context.
What might
the consequences be for Christians seeking the therapy when there's this spiritual element to it?
Well, I think it's actually a much bigger question than what Christians think about it, you know, or how it affects Christians. I mean, humans, you know. I mean, maybe it's because I spent most of my career as a religion reporter for a newspaper, reporting on religion. And but it seems to me that a lot of the positive outcomes from these clinical trials, not just about clergy, but anything, I think spirituality explains it much more than science. You know, these are scientists who are trying to build a case that this is scientifically and medically valid and, you know, it's therapeutic benefit, which I think it does. But in my opinion, it's really a spiritual. You hear these stories from people, any kind of clinical trial, and you actually hear their story. It sounds like a religious conversion story, you know. And these are even people who are atheists, Christians, Jews. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
I mean, they have. And what I think it is, it's spiritual in the sense that it's a radical re-envisioning of yourself, this sense of self and ego, and this connecting to a higher, what you might call a higher self or cosmic
self.
Consciousness or something. It's really the psychological way of maybe ego dissolution or, you know, connecting to some kind of a unitive, non-dual consciousness. It's really that, you know, and when people talk about it, and these are people, some people in my other books, you know, I've interviewed a lot of people. I have a book, Changing Our Minds, which came out before Michael Pollan's, How to Change Your Mind, where I interview a lot of these people who are in these other studies. Some of these were, you know, scientists themselves, and they call themselves atheists, but you hear their stories, they don't sound like atheists.
Yeah.
You know, and it's, so it's, those are, these are just words like, you know, mystical, spiritual, you know, there are scientific kind of, there's this hesitancy to use words like sacred and mystical because scientists think, or a lot of the researchers think, that it'll be dismissed because there's a bias against spirituality and mysticism in academic and scientific circles. I think that's kind of ignorance on their part, in my opinion. But they're worried, and I think it's a sincere worry, that the larger scientific academic community will just dismiss this. Oh, this is just a bunch of new age, you know, gobbledygook. So that's why they're, you know, like Roland goes out of his, and Roland is, you know, a very spiritual person. You can tell that just by talking to him, you know, not in any sort of necessarily Buddhist or denominational way. He calls it secular spirituality. I don't know what that is.
Yeah.
I mean, why? Like you put the word secular in front of it. Okay, now it's safe or something. You know, but there's a real dispute among the researchers at Johns Hopkins. Like, you know, like Matt Johnson, you know, who's one of the researchers there. He wrote a paper, I think published a paper last year, where he's very critical of this kind of new age amorphous mysticism that you can see in a lot of the clinical trial sort of discussion. And he thinks that that's dangerous because there'll be like a backlash, you know, from the scientific community.
Right.
So that debate is going on. It's interesting at MAPS now that there seem to be more open than, I mean, I was at the last MAPS meeting, what was that, 2017? You know, every year that seems to be more, they seem to be more open to acknowledging that this in some ways is spirituality and mysticism does really explain this in a lot of ways.
Yeah, 100%. I think 100%. And my personal perspective, I believe, is like science is amazing for the material world and understanding physical phenomena. But when it comes to questions like how do we want to live our life? Like what's important? What matters? Like what should I put my attention on? Like what path should I walk in life? Those it seems to be that the things that best address those questions aren't science textbooks.
Right.
I did a degree in physics thinking it's everything, right? And then it didn't help me answer those questions. So I ended up finding spiritual literature that seemed to address them directly.
Right, exactly. And that's why it's important to have, you know, some kind of a roadmap maybe to interpret this. It could be Christian, it could be Jewish, it could be Buddhist, it could be anything. For sure, yeah.
Curious. Let's say 10 years from now, 15 years from now, there's been a more widespread use of psychedelics among the general population. You know, we shared how it seems like people get a sense of this sort of spiritual dimension. You know, it's been curious. I've been curious to wonder if that would lead people to join these communities of discernment, or to start their own communities of discernment, or maybe to join the old school ones in some kind of conversion experience. Mm-hmm. And it, you know, they report it isn't necessarily the case that the mystical experience they have is a distinctly Christian one, or a distinctly Jewish one, or a distinctly Muslim one. How do you see the effects of this playing out at scale for religious institutions?
Yeah, well, I think what I'm interested in, and what I write about in God and Psychedelics, is there is a, you know, centuries, millennia-old tradition of mysticism. So let's just take Judaism and Christianity. You know, that's definitely there. But people of my generation, you know, the baby boomers, people who came of age in the, you know, the 50s and the 60s, this wasn't talked about in the churches and synagogues. I mean, they were the people who were brought up as Christians and just don't even know that this mystical tradition is there, right? So it's not that everyone's going to rush back to Christianity or Judaism when they have a, you know, a revelatory experience on psychedelics. But what's happening are these groups like, you know, SHEFA, a Jewish Christian Psychedelic Society, and Ligare, which is a Christian psychedelic society, both of which were started by participants in the Johns Hopkins study.
Yeah.
You know, there, now there's an opportunity, at least, for people who were brought up Christian or Jewish to explore what the mystical traditions in their own faith says about that. Now, maybe most people aren't going to do that. Maybe in some ways Buddhism can seem more compatible with these states of consciousness. Mm. You know, maybe it's often not so much a personal kind of God, like the God of the Bible that people are experiencing. Sometimes they are, sometimes they're not.
Right.
You know, or Hinduism or Vedanta or different forms of Easternness. So it's not like it's everything's happening at once. You know, it's not like one thing is going to happen. But I think there's just this new beginning of this new opening in some Christian and Jewish, not so much yet in Muslim circles. That's a little slower maybe to come along.
Yeah.
But just openness to exploring those possibilities.
You know? Yeah. Oh, and I'm curious on your thoughts on this. I've heard the term the demythologization Christianity is sort of like that. There's been this effect of modernity specifically on Christianity that sort of made it. And in the talk yesterday, or Reverend Hunt Priest, he spoke about how Christianity's become very intellectual and heady.
Right, irrational, yeah.
Yeah, and they've dismissed the body and sort of ignored the
body.
Well,
like I mentioned, he's the one who in Ligare. My interview, I mean, I think I was the first one he talked about that as a journalist, right? I wrote an article last year about his experience. Yeah, he felt that Holy Spirit and, you know. A lot of the, what they call the mainstream churches, which tend to be the more liberal ones, and the ones that are losing members the fastest, you know, like the Presbyterian Church, United Church of Christ, the Lutheran Church.
The Roman Catholic isn't losing them as fast.
Roman Catholic is a little different, you know. I mean, people are more kind of culturally Catholic, you know, like they're culturally Jewish. You know, there's more like switching among the Protestants. It's a little different, but they're all losing members.
Right.
But the ones that have embraced kind of a more progressive, rational, intellectual approach to the faith, they can be kind of lifeless, you know, and dull. Whereas the more conservative evangelical churches, especially the Pentecostal churches, I mean, they really do feel the Holy Spirit, you know. They are having spiritual experiences. You know, I think the real trend is related to this spiritual but not religious is people are more interested in personal spiritual experience rather than doctrine, dogma, and denominationalism. You know, so the churches that have that Holy Spirit, which tend to be the more conservative evangelical or Pentecostal ones, they're declining less, although even they are also declining now.
Right.
But there is a real crisis in, like, the two of the churches that I focus on in God and Psychedelics are the Episcopal Church and the Lutheran Church, meaning there's like a mainline Lutheran Church. And they are losing members so fast that the projections are within a couple of generations, they could be extinct. And then the Catholic Church too. I mean, the Catholic Church, it's a little different. I mean, the Catholic Church, as everyone knows, has been involved in, you know, now decades-long scandal involving sexual abuse of children and minors and the cover and at least as important as the cover-up by religious lead bishops and church leaders. And I think they're losing some members around that. But a lot of Catholics are still maybe will consider themselves culturally Catholic, you know, more so. It's hard to say. But it's a little different with the Catholic Church. It's also interesting that in this, they haven't actually said yet exactly what the breakdown is in terms of the denominations that participated in this. They gave a little hint of it yesterday in the presentation, but I think it's safe to say that Catholics are underrepresented in this this survey. So that's interesting. Why is that, you know?
Yeah. I'm curious, have you ever heard of the YouTuber and Eastern Orthodox icon carver Jonathan Pageau?
No.
Cool. He's Canadian.
Okay.
French-Canadian. And he's spoken with Jordan Peterson. He was a consultant, a friend of Jordan Peterson when he was doing his biblical series back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
And just following him, it seems that there's been sort of a revival on almost the opposite end of the Protestants, like all the way back to Orthodox, that some people are...
Oh, yeah, like Eastern Orthodox or Greek or Russian Orthodox.
Yeah.
That's been happening for a couple decades. There's been it's interesting, a lot of... conservative evangelicals, like Baptist or Pentecostals, are the opposite. Often they will sort of sometimes embrace this sort of high church, you know, kind of orthodoxy, which is that's been happening for a while. Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. Interesting. Yeah. How do you feel the Orthodox might react to the psychedelic potential incorporation?
Hard to say. You know, it's in a way the Eastern. Christian, like there's the Roman Catholic, and then there's the Eastern Catholic and the Orthodox.
The OGs.
We're more, in some ways, open to the Christian mysticism and spirituality than the Roman Church. Mm. So that doesn't mean they're going to embrace psychedelics.
Yeah.
You know, the important thing to remember is, and this is a lot of Christians who are even sympathetic to this will resent the fact that the psychedelic people tend to want to reduce everything to psychedelics. There are a lot of ways to have a mystical experience the way most people have mystical experiences.
100%.
Including going back millennia has nothing to do with psychedelics. You know, it's through prayer, fasting, meditation, you know, things like
ecstatic dance,
you know, chanting. Yeah. I mean, that's
spontaneously. Right.
Or spontaneously. Yeah.
For no reason.
Yeah.
We
tend to like, you can't reduce mysticism to psychedelics, you know, and there's a tendency, especially in this crowd, to do that, you know.
Yeah.
All religion started with psychedelic plants. Well, I mean, it's an interesting idea, and there's very little evidence of it actually, but it's like the sort of this conventional wisdom, you know, the stoned ape theory and the pagan continuity theory. You know, Brian Moriescu wrote this book, you know, what was it called? The Immortality.
Immortality Key.
Yeah. Which, you know, I mean, it's an interesting book. I write about that actually in God on Psychedelics, a critique of that. He admits it's total speculation.
Yeah.
You know, when you really push him on it, you know, it's like a wonderful story, but there really is very little evidence of it, you know.
And my first thought on that, I was speaking with a gentleman in Vancouver who said, I was just reading about the psychedelic roots of Christianity. I'm like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I'm sorry.
You think it might be more core to the story and the events and the theme and the narrative of Christianity would center on, you know, the thing that sparked it, you know what I mean? Like it wouldn't be like a side back room phenomenon. It would be more incorporated.
I mean, we really have no idea what was really going on in the early church, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, some people even don't, there are some people that think Jesus wasn't even a historical character. I think he was, you know, but you know, it's we're sort of projecting back onto this whatever preconceived ideas or stories that we want. We're mythologizing it in various ways, including the psychedelic mythology.
Yeah.
We don't really know, but it's, you know, there's very little evidence of it. You know, it's true that the once the church became associated with the empire, you know, they repressed all kinds of alternative forms of religion. Mostly nothing to do with psychedelics, just mysticism in general. you know, like the Gospel of Thomas, which, you know, is as authentic as, you know, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, you know, was repressed by the early church because of, I think, the mystical overtones there. Not that they were taking psychedelics, just that mystics in general are harder to control, right? They have their own ideas about the divine.
Yeah.
So there's a suspicion of, by Orthodox, of any religion to the mystical, because that's where the kind of the reformers show up. I mean, that's what happened with Jesus and Judaism, right?
Yeah.
So that's the history of religion, is people, mystics or prophets coming up with a new way of looking at this, and then there's a schism or a new religion forms, like Christianity out of Judaism, right? So that's the life cycle of religion.
Yeah.
Psychedelics may play a little part of that somewhere along the line, but it doesn't really explain the whole thing.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. And there's sort of I don't know if this is necessarily the case, but the word revelation has a lot of connotation to it, right? The Book of Revelations and everything. And people have revelatory experiences, it seems, under psychedelics. And that, you know, you could make a religion out of almost anything if you really wanted to.
we make a religion out of, you know, materialism and capitalism and consumerism. You know, our temples are the shopping malls, which of course now dying because of COVID and the internet and everything.
People are converting from consumerism to depression. to COVID depression.
Yeah,
it's interesting. And something that was very interesting was you spoke with Roland about sort of preconceived ideas that sort of sneak into the therapeutic context.
They expect it, they call it expectancy bias.
Yeah.
Or suggestibility. It's very easy to plant an idea in someone's mind, even if you're not intending to.
Yeah.
And a lot of the critique of all these clinical trials is that's happening a lot. And I think that does explain. I mean, people are actually having great therapeutic benefit. So, you know, it's like, what's the difference between intention and expectancy? Right? Everyone says, intention is important, but that's built into the idea of intention is I expect something to happen.
I'm
a wounded warrior, you know, from the war in Iraq, and I'm trying to deal with my PTSD. Well, you've heard all these other people, it's helped them. You expect it to work, and it works, and it does work. Partly because of the medicine, and partly because of the expectancy. That's how faith healing works. Forget about psychedelic faith healing.
Yeah. But
faith healing. And on the one hand, great, so what, you know?
Placebo works.
Yeah, placebo 20, works. But if you're trying to prove scientifically to get some exclusive patent or deal on some drug, then you don't want to acknowledge that, right?
Yeah.
So a lot of this, it's a very complicated thing that's going on with this, you know, commodification and commercialization of psychedelics, which is a whole other can of worms we don't have to get into.
Thankfully, we got the double-blind placebo to help too, so we can see that 30% effectiveness or 37 or whatever is sort of that range of effectiveness on the placebo, which is hilarious almost. But that's great for them.
got
those results.
And
if we use the word religion, sort of explode it and use it super broad to mean just like your sense of your relationship to the world, your understanding of yourself, the rituals that you have related to that, how that affects your cognition, how you even perceive things, how you categorize things, then certainly the word that reflects all that comes in when you do anything. Not just psychedelics, there's a ritual around how you drive your car too, you know?
So
it's useful to ask those questions, right?
One
thing they incorporate is the idea of letting go into, that's part of the protocol before people go into their psilocybin experiences.
Right, if you're afraid of something, you know, let go or approach it with curiosity, don't resist it, don't run away from it. Or just surrender to it, whatever.
And that seems like a very...
Which is a religious context too. Surrender to a power greater than themselves, right? I mean, Islam is a surrender, right? Islam means, and you know, all religious traditions have that idea.
Right.
They didn't just come up with this in the psychedelic world. Right.
And then imagine if before the psilocybin ceremony, you spoke about what the word Islam means, surrender, right? Instead of saying letting go, right? Same concept, different packaging, different intention, different expectancy. It's funny the nuance there. And I believe I was listening to maybe as a podcast of yours or someone else speaking about that concept of letting go and where it came from. And it was someone on Roland's team who sort of brought it in, someone who had been very active in maybe the underground. I'm not 100% clear on
that.
And they brought it in, but it was sort of this hazy background. They weren't sure where the concept of letting go was coming from, but it sort of emerged out of the general culture of psychedelia in the West. And so there
actually, like I said, it actually emerges out of religion in general, surrendering.
I've specifically heard the word letting go as being in sort of a New Age context. Like that.
Yeah,
that,
but it's just that's just another word for describing what, you know, like spiritual movements have talked about forever. You know,
yeah.
it's basically a way to calm the self and the selfishness and the self-centeredness, the ego. You know, I mean, this is what a lot of religions have been religions teach. They didn't just come up with this in the psychedelic counterculture. It's the same idea, in my opinion.
Yeah. So I'm curious, you personally, you know, you share about your experience with recovery and addiction, and that ketamine has been a very strong ally for you, very good medicine for you. And I'm curious for you if you've found sort of an intersection on the therapeutic benefits as well as like spiritual, not consequences, side effects, spiritual side effects. Or say the core of the shift that happens under psychedelics. How has the therapeutic versus this spiritual element of your own experiences bled into one each other, or how have they been different?
Well, I was first exposed to ketamine. I was actually working on another article, and I was interviewing a doctor on Maui. I actually happened to be Ram Dass's doctor when Ram Dass was still alive. And he had read Harvard Psychedelic Club, so we were talking about psychedelics. And then I guess I mentioned that I was on these SSRIs, you know, traditional antidepressants, you know, and they were working okay, but I was trying to get off of them. They weren't really working that well. And this is like 10 or 15 years ago or something, you know, 10 years ago. And he was saying, have you ever tried ketamine? Have you ever heard of ketamine as an for depression? And I hadn't heard this. There wasn't a lot of discussion 10 years ago about this. It was just starting to happen. And I said, no. And he said, would you like to try it? And wound up giving me an injection. I actually came back the next, I thought about it, I came back the next day. Yeah. Anyway, and it was a very powerful spiritual experience. So I did that. And then I actually was trying to get off antidepressants anyway, because I wanted to try ayahuasca for changing our minds, because they say it's a good idea to get off those. So anyway, for various reasons, I got off of them. And I did the ayahuasca, and I started exploring mainly as a journalist, writing that book, you know, to understand these drugs in the context I'm writing about, whether it's therapeutic or religious or spiritual. Anyway, so I came back, and then I discovered, you know, the ketamine lozenges, you know, which is a slightly gentler way to do have the ketamine experience. And it's they're legal with a doctor's prescription. So I did get into... I call it a ketamine music meditation, where I once every week or two I will, you know, put on my headset, my eye shades, you know, the standard protocol with a playlist of music that has personal meaning for me, and have a little experience for about an hour. And so the way I look at that now, it's partly therapeutic because it is helping me with my depression. It's temporary. That's the criticism of it.
Right.
So are SSRIs. So are most things, actually. It's maybe a third for me. It's not bad for me. It doesn't work for everyone. According to my doctor, who's really an authority on ketamine, I'm a really good responder to this. So it's not for everyone, for sure.
Right.
But for me, I see it, and I write about this in God and Psychedelics a little bit at the end, I think. It's like a third therapeutic. It does help as a treatment for depression. It's a third spiritual or religious that sometimes, not always, I will have a real non-dual mystical experience. It's very unpredictable with the exact same dose.
Interesting.
Sometimes it'll be almost no psychoactive effects. Sometimes it'll be little. Sometimes it'll be like they call the K-hole, or like, you know, that's kind of the recreational word, right? But I never took ketamine recreationally, but myself. But so other times it will be like a full-blown mystical experience, like what Shogun would call a +4 experience. And with the same dose, same conditions, same time of day. So it's very mysterious in that way. But And it's, in a sense, I have to admit, it's recreational because I like to get high. I like it too much. That's why I'm in recovery from other drugs, right? So for me, it's a third therapeutic, a third spiritual, and I'll admit, a third recreational. Recreational in the sense of not partying, but in the sense of exploring my own consciousness and just exploring that territory. You know, and what is this? You know, what's going on here, right? So it's all three of those things. And for me, it's the only thing I really do on any kind of a regular basis. I mean, I don't take any other drugs. I very rarely do, you know, mushrooms or MDMA. I did a little bit for the book. But I have to be very careful about that because I'm just, you know, I admit I love to get high. I love it too much. And so, but for me, I found a way, and ketamine does have a higher abuse potential. And it's not technically a psychedelic. Neither is MDMA, but they definitely have psychedelic qualities.
Manifesting, so long as it's manifesting.
It's not a classic psychedelic like LSD or peyote.
Although some people do seem to have visionary experiences on MDMA on occasion.
People do, even on ketamine. I don't. I mean, I'm sort of like Huxley. Huxley called himself a poor visualizer. He would, even on LSD, and I tend to not have, you know, visuals. Although sometimes like DMT, the chonga, you know, when I smoked that with the Sacred Garden Church, that was definitely the visuals. But everyone's different, and then, like I say, even your it's different from time to time when you explore this yourself.
Awesome. I also want to say take a moment to and thank you for sharing, and also thank you for being open with the recreational aspect too. I think Rick Doblin, he uses the word celebratory use.
I guess, like I think I tried to explain, it's more recreational. I say that because I do like to get high. So I like it, although occasionally I don't like it. It can be frightening. Very rarely in my case, but there may be another word. It's not really celebratory, be like more like a rave or a party or something. It's more like exploratory. Might be a better word than recreational. Exploratory. Exploratory. What is this thing we call consciousness? And as Roland pointed out, these scientists, they don't have a clue. They you know, they have all these, you know, brain scans and imaging, and most of that is just, you know, they overinterpret, these images, this imaging, I think. They're that's why they have the research. They're trying to figure it out. But I think ultimately it's sort of beyond figuring out in some ways.
Have you heard of the research of John Verbeke out of the University of Toronto in Canada?
No, sorry.
He's a cognitive scientist.
I'm not really up to speed on the latest stuff, even not just because it's Canada. But the last few years I've been focusing more on the religious and spiritual side for this book.
For sure. He redefines consciousness as relevance realization, and then talks about, because it's such a big word, consciousness. And then relevance realization is something he dives into. Could be interesting.
That's interesting.
And just want to plug the Canadians, so.
Oh,
and also what I was saying is, I'll take a moment too to say, please subscribe to MAPS Canada YouTube channel. And if you'd like to support our mission of supporting equitable access and legal access to psychedelic medicines in Canada, please donate at the link below. And you can also find a link to Don Lanton's book and website on there. We'll throw that down there too.
Thank you.
So make sure to check that out. Don, is there anything else that you'd like to leave to a message to Canadians specifically by chance, or generally for people who are maybe newer to exploring psychedelics?
No, I think we've covered a lot of it. I mean, I think Canada has an interest, as you probably know, has a very interesting history early on with, you know, Humphrey Osmond and the work. And, you know, it was Humphrey Osmond who turned on Aldous Huxley, you know, so.
Was he the one that coined the term psychedelic?
Humphrey Osmond is sort of in conjunction with Huxley. The word in the 50s that was being used was psychomimetic, meaning it mimics psychosis. And that has kind of a negative connotation. So they were looking for a more neutral word. And so they would, like, they were writing, there's a correspondence about this. They're suggesting possible words. And and they would write a little poem or couplet, you know, with it, you know, and the famous letter is Humphrey Osmond, you know, writes to Huxley and says, what about, you know, psychedelic? And one of them, I forget which, maybe it was Humphrey Osmond, said, you know, to fathom hell or soar angelic, take a pinch of psychedelic. Which was great because it shows there is a heaven and hell. Yeah, it's not just all, you know, bunnies and bliss, right?
Yeah.
And so when they came up with that, they decided psychedelic. And it, you know, it took a few years, but it became the go-to word. Now people don't like it because it has all this baggage about, you know, the Grateful Dead and the hippies and, you know, Leary and Ken Kesey, and people want to use entheogen.
Yeah.
Which is a kind of a loaded word because that, I mean, psychedelic just means mind manifesting.
Yeah.
But anyway, so you can, there you go. We can thank the Canadians for the word.
Yeah, right? There we go.
All right.
Canada coined, officially coined the
Hail
term.
Hail Canada, so. Yeah.
Let's go. Who coined the term entheogen? Was that also in there?
You know, there's a debate about that. Somebody just, because they're, you know, in this book, there's a quote from Houston Smith from the 60s where he seems to use the word entheogen. I think Carl Ruck, another later researcher, says he came up with it. I don't really know. And it might be that Houston was writing later about rewrote a paper he had done and started using the word entheogen. It's unclear.
Right.
But yeah, it's a more recent word. And I don't like to, as a journalist, I don't like to use it because it implies that you think this is the divine. Where you know, it's sort of like saying, pro-life if you're against abortion rights. You know, it's a loaded word, right?
Right, yeah.
And so I definitely think these medicines or drugs can open us up to the divine. But to say that, but not maybe not for everyone or not all the time. So
yeah.
The thing that's nice about psychedelic is it's kind of neutral,
right, yeah,
mind
yeah.
manifesting.
It's like an earlier layer. It's like,
yeah,
it's not always God containing necessarily, because some of your experiences are strictly sort of therapeutic, biological, biographical content, right?
Yeah.
Stan Grof's, you know, levels of the psyche. It's the biographical layer, perinatal, then transpersonal, and you don't necessarily get to the transpersonal in your holotropic breathwork or other, any modality of spiritual
good
work,
point.
Right?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
All right.
Awesome.
Well, thank you very much.
I think that's everything. Okay, thank you,
man.
Don.
Yeah,
awesome.
Enjoyed it.
Thank
you
for having me. Go subscribe.